series of Calm and North Fork Works. Today we're talking about seeds, and it's a pleasure to introduce you to Sylvia Davatz, a well-known seed saver and organic gardener from central Vermont. Although she doesn't live on the North Fork, Sylvia belongs right in the center of our program today because of her collaborative work with North Fork farmer Steph Gaylor, a previous guest on this show who we'll hear from at the end of the program. After many years of collecting seeds, Sylvia has decided to hand a portion of her collection to Steph. Will you miss the seeds you no longer have? I asked Sylvia.
That's a very interesting question. When I receive seeds, I feel an enormous sense of responsibility. I feel that something, some treasure has been handed off to me. I'm very aware of the fact that I am simply one tiny, tiny link in this chain that extends through about 10,000 years of domesticated agriculture, and that these seeds are something, they're on a path, and they're coming through me, and it is my responsibility to make sure they are preserved, either in the form that they were given to me or in some form that they will evolve into over the course of time that I have them in my own garden, to pass them on to someone else who will come after me.
As adapted seeds somehow.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, exactly. So I'm really in many ways just a seed agent. I've been saving seed for over 20 years, but I've always been very drawn to activities around self-sufficiency and providing for oneself and gaining familiarity with and currency with most basic skills that sustain our daily life. So I was very drawn to gardening, and it felt at some point as if the very next step beyond that to get deeper was not to just grow the crops themselves, but to grow the seeds of those various crops.
For continuity.
Originally just for myself, for my own garden. I then eventually became a member of the Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. It's the oldest domestic or American nonprofit that we have that is dedicated to seed saving. It publishes every year a winter yearbook, which is several hundred pages of vegetable and herb and grain varieties that are maintained by individual seed savers in their own gardens or on their own farms. It is a phenomenal network of people who are dedicated to this and who are knowledgeable about it. And through that, I began to build a collection of seeds. I always had very specific interests. I was very interested in collecting varieties that were adapted or could be adapted to the very specific region where I live, which is central Vermont, in support of a local year-round food system, which I had hoped to contribute to building. So I began collecting varieties, and what I loved about it was that in addition to collecting varieties, I was collecting friends. I was collecting seed savers. It is the most wonderful, rich, diverse, often eccentric collection of people who are dedicated to this and have unusual varieties.
Tell me more about who these people are. What do they have in common?
What they have in common is their passion for seed saving, their interest in rare and possibly endangered varieties, or varieties that have a connection for them to either personal history or a cultural context. They are sometimes breeders, but not always. They are sometimes dedicated to maintaining, for instance, the purity of the varieties that they have in their collections. They are often poets. They're sometimes plant shamans. They're people who write to me in pencil on lined paper. They are as interesting and unusual as the seeds. They are all over the country and to some extent all over the world. There's this interesting duality in what I do. I'm very interested in cultivating a local culture of seed saving, a local community that's collaborative and cooperative and based where I live. We have the terrain in common. We have our common food future. Mm. We have a collaboration in this pursuit in common. At the same time, there are people in other parts of the country and in other parts of the world that I have received varieties from that have become part of my collection that are either that are adaptable to where I live or that will constitute a very important part of the whole spectrum of foods that we're able to grow where we live.
To expand it.
To expand it, exactly. And this is another thing that I really love doing, and that's an integral part of what I'm doing. Very interested in building the broadest possible base of different foods that we can grow. So I grow grains, I grow rice, I experiment with foods that are borderline for where I live. For instance, I will grow peanuts, I've grown sweet potatoes, things that people never associate with a growing environment in central Vermont.
So what did it take, for instance, to take, let's say, the peanuts or the sweet potatoes, what did it take for you to adapt them to your environment?
What I have always done is read whatever literature is available, and from that, select varieties that have the potential to thrive where I am. So, for instance, with sweet potatoes, I would look for varieties that were very early maturing. With peanuts, I simply ordered or requested from fellow seed savers whatever varieties were available to me and then trialed them. I love doing trials. So I will, for instance, look to bring into my garden as many different varieties of a particular species that I'm interested in exploring.
Like sweet potatoes
or like peanuts, as many different varieties, or something that is more intuitively logical for where I am, like onions, as many varieties as possible, and trial them all in the same year and carefully observe.
I mean, how do you keep track of, if you do have planted a whole bunch of them?
Very careful labeling, very careful record keeping, very careful observation over the course of the growing season.
So you have notebooks and stuff?
I do, and I actually really love that part. I love the detail-oriented part of it, of keeping careful written records, making spreadsheets, photographing different crops at different stages and at their mature state, little hand labels in the ground, separating things within the garden if necessary so that I can keep better track of what I'm growing.
What do you have there now? Oh, well, it's the winter's coming in now, but what did you have there this year?
One of the things I was very excited about was that I'm trialing different varieties of upland or dryland rice. I received from a fellow seed saver a number of Russian varieties that are very early to flower.
Why is that important?
My growing season is very short. I need to make sure that whatever varieties I trial will have the potential to mature and ideally also to produce mature seed within the time that I have available to me in the growing season, between the last frost in spring and the first frost in the fall. Mm.
So how many months is that where you live?
This is shifting. You know, climate change is very, very real. Last frost in the spring is at least a couple of weeks earlier than it used to be. Mm. And the first frost in the fall is at least a couple of weeks later than it used to be about 25 years ago.
Mm. So it's extended by about 4 weeks?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Within just an absurdly, shockingly short amount of time, which is about 25 years.
Right. You have a longer season now.
A longer season, but it also means that there's the incursion of more pests, more insects that I did not see when I first moved to this spot in Vermont. There are increased pressures from different diseases that I did not encounter early on. So everything is shifting. Everything is shifting. The nature of the seasons, the nature of the summer is changing. We used to have very steady rainfall over the course of the summer, and it was usually a very gentle rain when it came. We now have more violent rainstorms, so we'll get a fair amount of rain, but it will come down much more forcefully in a short amount of time.
So here you are in Mattituck. You've been here before?
I have not been here before. I met Steph about 3 years ago at a seed conference. And at the time, I was looking for someone to take on responsibility for many of the seed varieties that I have.
Didn't want to do them anymore?
I'm getting older. I simply am not as capable physically of doing what I used to do 20 years ago. It's a slightly lower level of energy. It takes me longer to do things. Seed saving, per se, it really extends throughout the entire growing season. Biennials or perennials, I might have the first seed maturing in May, for instance, and of the later maturing varieties, the last will be ripening and be ready for harvest maybe in October or even beginning of November. So there's work to do all season long. Mm-hmm. Also because I'm very concerned about succession, about the next generation of seed savers. Who's going to take on responsibility? Who are they? Where are they? Are they going to have access to the seeds? Who's going to understand the importance of this work?
What is the importance?
The importance of this work is put in the simplest of terms, there is no food without seed. There's no food without seed. I think that we've succeeded in recent years in raising awareness about the importance of sourcing our food locally, but we have not thought in sufficient depth about the importance of raising our local food from seed that's been grown locally. And part of the reason that's so key is that not just varieties will adapt to a local environment, but the seeds themselves will adapt. So there's information in the seed that has already been transferred from the mother plant that informs the seed about things like germination, when to germinate, under what conditions. It's quite phenomenal and kind of breathtaking to think about things at that level, at that depth. For instance, let me just give you a quick example. In the Seed Savers Yearbook, which is, again, this volume that contains seeds that are being offered by a number of seed savers from their own gardens, you pay a nominal amount for a sample of seeds from each of these seed savers. So when I started, there were three or four categories of onions. Yellow, red, white, multiplier onions. Now there's only one category. So just that one category has shrunk down because seed savers who were offering these seeds in the past have retired from it, have died, have been killed by their tractors, have given up listing. So the number and the range and the variety of seeds that are being offered that are even available to us has shrunk dramatically, extremely alarming. Mm. And so I think we need to be thinking about what remains, how do we preserve it, how do we think about biodiversity in general, in the largest sense, and how do we impart on the next generation the urgency of this? It's not glamorous work. You know, it's very quiet, very under the radar work.
But you're all noisy when you get together or something?
I hope so, yes.
Sylvia DeVartz is talking about saving seeds. This is North Fork Works on WPKN Radio.
Yeah, and Steph is part of a network. You know, I think we're beginning to activate this conversation among ourselves to a greater extent and partly, again, motivated by a sense of urgency.
So what is the urgency?
We've lost a staggering number of varieties. We have lost 97% of all varieties that were commercially available since the beginning of the 20th century.
Really?
And if you think of each of those varieties as being a vessel of unique genetic information and content, and to have lost that is staggering, really.
Is it the commercial imperative is no longer there? I mean, the commercial seed companies are saying we don't need to have that many seeds. What is the decline from?
I think that in this culture, we value newness. And seed catalogs will generally offer a particular variety for about 5 years, and they will then feel that it needs to be replaced by something new. Commercial seed companies are businesses, but it also means that there's a certain turnover in what is available to the public. So I think the fact that this is driven by commerce has something to do with the loss. Mm-hmm. So our priorities have shifted away from simply the imperative to maintain genetic diversity or to maintain varieties that are part of a culture, for instance, an important part of a specific
like an ethnic
culture. Ethnic, or that have an interesting history. Or mm-hmm. that. One key element of seed saving is that in order to save seed of a particular variety, you need to start with what's called an open pollinated variety, which is a variety the seed of which will come true to type when it is replanted. And when I think of older varieties, I think of ones that have historic or personal importance, cultural importance, importance and value as ingredients in traditional foods, for instance.
Give me an example of what that might be.
Oh, let's see. You could think, for instance, of indigenous corn varieties. Mm. And there are movements around the country and in particular geographic areas to bring these varieties back into prominence, to bring them back into cultivation, to return the seed to tribes or to groups within which they originated and to whom they have enormous cultural importance. Yeah. But one of the reasons that I personally am very interested in older varieties, so that's heirloom, and beyond that, even older than that, ancient grains, for instance, I'm very interested in some of the first grains that were to emerge and which were incorporated and domesticated, is that they have nutritional value that might very well be lacking from many of the newer varieties that have been subject to breeding and that have been developed specifically to thrive under chemical and industrial cultivation, which means that you're feeding the plant rather than feeding the soil. We're now coming back to realizing that the health of the soil is the foundation of absolutely everything. And it contributes to the nutritional profile of the plants that are grown that way. And it's also healthy soil is also a carbon sink. So in terms of our ability to address climate change, I mean, one of the most important ways we can address that is by cultivating healthy soil. In other words, it is actually capable of drawing carbon out of the air and storing it in the soil.
Help me imagine if I walked into your house, how do the seeds look?
If you walked into my living room right now, and in the middle of November, you would see most surfaces in the living room covered with containers of seed that have been threshed and cleaned and that are waiting to be labeled. They're not even labeled yet. When I am getting my seeds from the current season ready for storage, I will pack them in containers and usually in plastic and Ziploc bags with the year of the harvest, the specific name of the variety, what seed that seed batch was grown from, so that I know how far back I went in my collection. So then the seed, it's carefully documented, labeled, packed, and then it goes down into my root cellar, where I have containers and containers and containers of seeds. They're sort of really large plastic lidded containers.
And so the plastic bags go into
those according to what it is. You know, there's an entire container of barley, an entire one of winter wheats. There are two containers of different bean varieties, A to K and then L to Z. You know, so each species has its own container, and that's where I keep backup seed. And then I have seed stock, the best quality seed that I will use to grow subsequent generations. I have samples of those kept in refrigerators, which means that they're kept at ideal temperatures to ensure maximum longevity of the seed, year-round constant temperature. So they're basically kept at dormancy until I need them. And it's guaranteeing their survival.
So is that like that big seed
vault
in Scandinavia?
The Svalbard vault. Don't get me started on that. My feeling about seed is that Varieties need to be grown out every season or as close to every season as possible in order to give them maximum capability to adapt to the environment in which they are being maintained. The problem with a seed vault like Svalbard is that all the seeds are kept in deep freeze, which means their characteristics and their traits are fixed in whatever year they were last grown out. And they have not been given the opportunity since then to adapt. And because of climate change, our environments locally are changing so rapidly that seeds need to be given every opportunity to constantly adapt. And if you take tomato seed that was last grown 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and you bring it out for regrowing in an environment that's radically changed since that time, you don't have adapted seed.
I see.
One of my most favorite sources of different varieties is the USDA Seed Bank, which is a national treasure. It's located in different places in this country. They're being maintained in parts of the country that are best suited to growing out and refreshing the seed that's in the collection. Maintained means replanting at appropriate intervals to maintain the viability of the seed. So any American citizen can request seed from the seed bank. I mean, this is really a national treasure. It's the USDA. That's right. Many of my favorite varieties have been retrieved from the USDA collection. My understanding is that because these seeds have been in a seed bank for however long, what you don't know when you get your 5 grams of seed, it could take 2 to 5 years of growing out in order to restore the full vitality of that particular variety.
You find that you are still gathering new ones, that you can't stop adding to your collection?
Seed saving is absolutely addictive, so compelling. It is extremely difficult to resist trialing new varieties. Mm-hmm. You know, your curiosity, you're just insatiable in that regard. But what's happened now is that since I passed on my seed catalog, I'm extraordinarily fortunate. I'm blessed to have a next-door neighbor who's a farmer, who's young, and who is passionately interested in seed saving, and who's taken on responsibilities. It was a seed catalog of all open-pollinated varieties. I had an email list, and I would send the catalog to everyone who was on the email. All the things that were in my collection that I had sufficient pure seed of, where I felt comfortable passing on the seed to others. Brian has taken on responsibility for all of the varieties, and because we're right next door to each other, we need to collaborate very closely. Mm-hmm. Who is growing what on isolation distances, on what seed needs to be replenished. So we have several conversations over the course of the beginning of the growing season as to what we're going to grow. He has added some of his own varieties to the catalog, so I've been able to hand that off to a successor.
I think we should bring in Steph, who's sitting here rather patiently, or impatiently maybe. Thank you very much, Sylvia. And I'm glad I've been part of your first time in Matatuck. The two of you will be going to the event tonight at the Museum of Food and Drink. Steph Gett of Invincible Summer Farms, talk about this event tonight and what kinds of things will be discussed.
Seed ethics is, how do we treat seeds? How do we bring them into the seed commons? Is there such thing as intellectual property if somebody's breeding new varieties? How do we treat a narrative of a seed? So these are community-wide issues, and that's primarily the genesis of all of these seed town halls that we're having. It's to foment a wider conversation rather than having a panel and a Q&A. It's to really have a discussion with everybody, because everybody could be an agent of change within the food system rather than relying on people who are quote-unquote experts. The seed commons, we think that we have a right to all the seeds, and we either phrase it or frame it in terms of very black and white. Either it belongs to everybody or it belongs to nobody in terms of patenting and GMOs, in terms of ethics. I'm not exactly sure if gender issues with seeds. I know for some people there it's an issue. I find that to be not an issue. But I think you have to hear about what they grapple with themselves, or how they feel alienated or frustrated. There's talking about biodiversity, but in talking about it, we actually have less, because we have people talking about it, but not actually putting anything behind it. With the seed system, it's a democracy. You have to participate. So whether or not you save seeds, you can be that agent of change because you're making decisions about the food you purchase and the kinds of questions you ask about what you're eating. It's almost like the discussions we've had about cultural identity. Mm-hmm. Who gets to own the idea, the concept of hummus? It's the same thing if you're buying a polenta corn. Is that an indigenous corn? Is the person who's selling it to you selling it in an ethical way that's keeping in line with those cultural values, or is it appropriation of an identity? So even educating yourself in terms of what you're buying and the variety it is having a voice and agency in this dialogue.
It's beyond the discussion of pollinating and things?
Absolutely. That's a very surface area that everybody's very comfortable discussing, like the technicalities of seed saving. And that is just the smallest part about saving seeds. How are we saving them? Are we saving them in a way that has a standard of practice? Are we just reading things on the internet? Well, seed saving is easy, and I could just read about it. It's like getting diagnosed with cancer and reading how to solve it on WebMD. You would never do something like that. And we're fast and loose with how we save seeds. And it's critical that it's done within that standard of practice of what seed savers have been doing for millennia. All of these conversations, it's always an abstraction. I save seeds within the seed library or at some evil, bad company that has GMOs. But we forget how our choices in the middle or lack of them affects, that's the majority of the system. We talk about these two extreme poles, but we don't talk about the middle. These conversations are not designed to come up with an end result. It's designed to deconstruct it. The basis of all food is seeds. And otherwise, we're foraging grasses again. I mean, the purpose of agriculture, that's what made us a civilized society. So if we're not concentrating on that civilization and seed curation and food, then we should just go back to eating weeds and finding these wild ancestors, hunting and gathering, so foraging.
Did you want to ask anything else, Sylvia?
You framed it very well. Mm-hmm. I think you explained very, very well what the central questions of seed ethics are, ownership or non-ownership, who has rights to what seeds or doesn't, and how do they get passed on and to whom and under what circumstances and with any attached conditions or not. And then also bringing it into a wider conversation about the entire food system. And one of the questions I raised with Steph this morning is, we want to engage people. We want to rattle their perch and get them thinking about this really carefully. And so how do we communicate to someone who lives on the 11th floor in an apartment on the Upper East Side that they can be part of this and that they have agency and have power in all of this? And that's really important because I think people tend to feel powerless. We don't want to just disturb them and get them rattled. We want to also give them a sense of agency in this and a sense of power.
All these contentious conversations, it's not just we've rattled each other's cages privately. So it's challenging somebody's assumptions. And that's very easy to do on a small scale, person to person. And we've both done that, you know, you and I and Hazel and I. So I think having that sense of we disagree about this, or somebody's questioning some firmly held belief that you've had your own echo chamber about, is vital. And that's what these seed town halls are meant to do, in a kind but a challenging way, because we can't keep going the way we're going.
Is there going to be another town hall after the one tonight? How can people find out about it?
They could go to lirsc.org.
So thank you very much.
Thank you,
Steph.
Hazel.
Thank you very much, Sylvia.
Thank you,
lovely.
Hazel.
I'm so glad we did this. Many thanks.
You've been listening to Sylvia DeVatz and Steph Gaylor talking about saving seeds. You can hear more North Fork Works programs on the first Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. and also anytime as podcasts on hazelkahn.com. North Fork Works programs are produced by Tony Ernst.